minus 80, and counting. Killian was in the wings and convulsed with amusement.
Fine performance, Mr. Richards, fine! God, I wish I could give you a bonus. Those fingers? Superb!
We aim to please, Richards said. The monitors were dissolving to a promo.
Give me the goddamn camera and go fuck yourself. Well, that's generically impossible, Killian said, still grinning. But here's the camera.
He took it from the technico who had been cradling it.
Fully loaded and ready to go. And here are the clips.
He handed Richards a small, surprisingly heavy, oblong box wrapped in oilcloth. Richards dropped the camera into one coat pocket, the clips into the other.
Okay, where's the elevator? Not so fast, Killian said. You got a minute. 12 of them, actually. Your 12 hours leeway doesn't start officially until 6:30.
The screams of rage had begun again. Looking over his shoulder, Richards saw that Laughlin was on. His heart went out to him.
I like you, Richards, and I think you'll do well, Killian said. You have a certain crude style that I enjoy immensely. I'm a collector, you know. Cave art and Egyptian artifacts are my areas of specialization. You are more analogous to the cave art than to my Egyptian urns, but no matter. I wish you could be preserved. Collected, if you please, just as my Asian cave paintings have been collected and preserved.
Grab a recording of my brainwaves, you bastard. They're on record.
So I'd like to give you a piece of advice, Killian said, ignoring him. You don't really have a chance. Nobody does, with the whole nation in on the manhunt and with the incredibly sophisticated equipment and training that the hunters have. But if you stay low, you'll last longer. Use your legs instead of any weapons you happen to pick up, and stay close to your own people.
He leveled a finger at Richards in emphasis.
Not these good middle-class folks out there. They hate your guts. You symbolize all the fears of this dark and broken time. It wasn't all show and audience packing out there, Richards. They hate your guts. Could you feel it?
Yes, Richards said.
I felt it.
I hate them too. Killian smiled.
That's why they're killing you.
He took Richard's arm. His grip was surprisingly strong.
This way.
Behind them, Laughlin was being ragged by Bobby Thompson to the audience's satisfaction. Down a white corridor, their footfalls echoing hollowly, alone, all alone. One elevator at the end.
This is where you and I part company, Killian said. Express to the street. 9 seconds.
He offered his hand for the fourth time, and Richards refused it again. Yet he lingered a moment.
What if I could go up?
He asked, and gestured with his head toward the ceiling and the 80 stories above the ceiling.
Who could I kill up there? Who could I kill if I went right to the top?
Killian laughed softly and punched the button beside the elevator. The doors popped open.
That's what I like about you, Richards. You think big.
Richards stepped into the elevator. The doors slid toward each other.
Stay low,
Killian repeated. And then Richards was alone. The bottom dropped out of his stomach as the elevator sank toward the street. Minus 79, and counting. The elevator opened directly onto the street. A cop was standing by its frontage on Nixon Memorial Park, but he did not look at Richards as he stepped out, only tapped his move along reflectively and stared into the soft drizzle that filled the air. The drizzle had brought early dusk to the city. The lights glowed mystically through the darkness, and the people moving on Rampart Street in the shadow of the Games Building were only insubstantial shadows, as Richards knew he must be himself. He breathed deeply of the wet, sulfur-tainted air. It was good, in spite of the taste. It seemed that he had just been let out of prison, rather than from one communicating cell to another. The air was good. The air was fine.
Stay close to your own people, Killian had said. Of course he was right. Richards hadn't needed Killian to tell him that, or to know that the heat would be heaviest in Co-op City when the truce broke at noon tomorrow. But by then, he would be over the hills and far away. He walked 3 blocks and hailed a taxi. He was hoping the cap's freebie would be busted. A lot of them were, but this one was in A1 working order and blaring the closing credits of The Running Man.
Shit. Where, buddy?
Robart Street. That was 5 blocks from his destination. When the cab dropped him, he would go Backyard Express to Molly's place. The cab accelerated, ancient gas-powered engine, a discordant symphony of pounding pistons and manifold noise. Richard slumped back against the vinyl cushions into what he hoped was deeper shadow.
Hey, I just seen you on the freebie,
the cabbie exclaimed.
You're that guy, Pritchard.
Pritchard, that's right, Richard said resignedly. The games building was dwindling behind them. A psychological shadow seemed to be dwindling proportionally in his mind, in spite of the bad luck with the cabbie.
Jesus, you got balls, buddy. I'll say that, you really do. Christ, they'll kill you. You know that? They'll kill your fucking eye dead. You must really have balls.
That's right. 2 of them, just like you.
2 of them,
the cabbie repeated. He was ecstatic.
Oh, Jesus, that's good. That's hot. You mind if I tell my wife I had his affair? She goes batshit for the games. I'll have to report you, too, but Christ, I won't get no 100 for it. Cabby's got to have at least one supporting witness, you know? Knowing my luck, no one saw you getting in.
That would be tough, Richard said. I'm sorry you can't help kill me. Should I leave a note saying I was here?
Oh, Jesus, could you? That'd be...
They just crossed the canal. Let me out here, Richard said abruptly. He pulled a new dollar from the envelope Thompson had handed him and dropped it on the front seat.
Gee, I didn't say nothing, did I? I didn't mean to...
No, Richard said.
Could you give me that note?
Get stuffed, maggot. He lunged out and began walking toward Drummond Street. Co-op City rose skeletal in the gathering darkness before him. The cabbie's yell floated after him.
I hope they get you early, you cheap fuck!
-78 and counting. Through a backyard, through a ragged hole in a cyclone fence separating one barren asphalt desert from another, across a ghostly abandoned construction site, pausing far back in shattered shadows as a cycle pack roared by, headlamps glaring in the dark like the psychopathic eyes of nocturnal werewolves. Then over a final fence, cutting one hand, and he was rapping on Molly Jernigan's back door, which is to say, the main entrance. Molly ran a Dock Street hock shop where a fellow with enough bucks to spread around could buy a police special move-along, a full-choke riot gun, a submachine gun, heroin, push, cocaine, drag disguises, a Styroflex pseudo-woman, a real whore if you were too strapped to afford Styroflex, the current address of 1 of 3 floating crap games, the current address of a swinging perverto club, or 100 other illegal items. If Molly didn't have what you wanted, he would order it for you, including false papers. When he opened the peephole and saw who was there, he offered a kindly smile and said, "Why don't you go away, pal? I never saw you." "New dollars," Richards remarked, as if to the air itself. There was a pause. Richards studied the cuff of his shirt as if he had never seen it before. Then the bolts and locks were opened, quickly, as if Molly were afraid Richards would change his mind. Richards came in. They were in Molly's place behind the store, which was a rat-worn of old newsies, stolen musical instruments, stolen cameras, and boxes of black market groceries. Molly was by necessity something of a Robin Hood. A pawnbroker south of the canal did not remain in business long if he became too greedy. Molly took the rich uptown maggots as heavily as he could and sold in the neighborhood at close to cost, something lower than cost if some pal was being squeezed hard. Thus, his reputation in Co-op City was excellent, his protection superb. If a cop asked a South City stoolie, and there were hundreds of them,
about Molly Jernigan? The informant let it be known that Molly was a slightly senile old-timer who took a little graft and sold a little black market. Any number of uptown swells with strange sexual tendencies could have told the police differently, but there were no vice busts anymore. Everyone knew vice was bad for any real revolutionary climate. The fact that Molly also ran a moderately profitable trade in forged documents, strictly for local customers, was unknown uptown. Still, Richards knew tooling papers for someone as hot as he was would be extremely dangerous.
"What papers?" Molly asked,
sighing deeply and turning on an ancient gooseneck lamp that flooded the working area of his desk with bright white light. He was an old man, approaching 75, and in the close glow of the light his hair looked like spun silver.
"A driver's license, a military service card, street identicard, actual charge card, social retirement card."
"Easy. A $60 job for anyone but you, Benny."
"You'll do it?"
"For your wife, I'll do it. For you, no.
I don't put my head in the noose for any crazy-ass bastard like Benny Richards."
"How long, Molly?" Molly's eyes flashed sardonically.
"Knowing your situation as I do, I'll hurry it. An hour for each."
"Christ, 5 hours? Can I go?"
"No, you can't."
"Are you nuts, Benny?
A cop comes pulling up to your development last week. He's got an envelope for your old lady. It came in a black wagon with about 6 buddies. Flapper Donegan was standing on the corner pitching nicks with Gary Hanrahan when it transpired. Flapper tells me everything. The boy's soft, you know."
"I know Flapper's soft," Richard said impatiently. "I sent the money. Is she—"
"Who knows? Who sees?"
Molly shrugged and rolled his eyes as he put pens and blank forms in the center of the pool of light thrown by the lamp.
"They're 4 deep around your building, Benny. Anyone who's sent to offer their condolences would end up in a cellar talking to a bunch of rubber clubs. Even good friends don't need that scam, not even with your old lady flush. You got a name you want special on these?"
"Doesn't matter, as long as it's Anglo."
"Jesus, Molly, she must have come out for groceries, and the doctor—"
"She sent Budgio Sanchez's kid. What's his name?"
"Walt."
"Yeah, that's it. I can't keep the goddamn spics and mix straight no more. I'm getting senile, Benny.
Blowing my cool."
He glared up at Richard suddenly.
"I remember when Mick Jagger was a big name. You don't even know who he was, do you?"
"I know who he was," Richard said, distraught.
He turned to Molly's sidewalk-level window, frightened. It was worse than he thought. Sheila and Kathy were in the cage, too. At least until—
"They're okay, Benny,"
Molly said softly.
"Just stay away. You're poison to them now. Can you dig it?"
"Yes,"
Richard said. He was suddenly overwhelmed with despair, black and awful. "I'm homesick," he thought, amazed. But it was more, it was worse. Everything seemed out of whack, surreal. The very fabric of existence bulging at the seams, faces whirling, Laughlin, Burns, Killian, Jansky, Molly, Kathy, Sheila. He looked out into the blackness, trembling. Molly had gone to work, crooning some old song from his vacant past, something about having Betty Davis eyes.
Who the hell was that?
"He was a drummer,"
Richard said suddenly.
"With that English group, the Beatles. Mick McCartney."
"Yeah, you kids,"
Molly said, bent over his work.
"That's all you kids know."
-77 and counting. He left Molly's at 10 past midnight, $1,200 lighter. The pawnbroker had also sold him a limited but fairly effective disguise. Gray hair, spectacles, mouth wadding, plastic buck teeth, which suddenly transfigured his lip line.
"Give yourself a little limp, too," Molly advised. "Not a big attention getter, just a little one. Remember,
You have the power to cloud men's minds, if you use it.
Don't remember that line, do you?
Richards didn't.
According to his new wallet cards, he was John Griffin Springer, a Textape salesman from Harding. He was a 43-year-old widower. No Technico status, but that was just as well. Technicos had their own language.
Richards reemerged on Robart Street at 12:30, a good hour to get rolled, mugged, or killed, but a bad hour to make any kind of unnoticed getaway. Still, he had lived south of the canal all his life. He crossed the canal 2 miles farther west, almost on the edge of the lake. He saw a party of drunken winos huddled around a furtive fire, several rats, but no cops. By 1:15 a.m., he was cutting across the far edge of the no man's land of warehouses, cheap beaneries, and shipping offices on the north side of the canal. At 1:30, he was surrounded by enough uptowners hopping from one sleazy dive to the next to safely hail a cab. This time the driver didn't give him a second look.
"Jetport," Richard said.
"I'm your man, pal."
The air thrusters shoved them up into traffic. They were at the airport by 1:50. Richards limped past several cops and security guards who showed no interest in him. He bought a ticket to New York because it came naturally to mind. The ID check was routine and uneventful. He was on the 220 speed shuttle to New York. There were only 40 or so passengers, most of them snoozing businessmen and students. The cop in the Judas hole dozed through the entire trip. After a while, Richards dozed too. They touched down at 3:06, and Richards deplaned and left the airport without incident. At 3:15, the cab was spiraling down the Lindsay Overway. They crossed Central Park on a diagonal, and at 3:20, Ben Richards disappeared into the largest city on the face of the earth. -76, and counting. He went to Earth in the Brandt Hotel, a so-so establishment on the east side. That part of the city had been gradually entering a new cycle of chic. Yet the Brandt was less than a mile from Manhattan's own blighted inner city, also the largest in the world. As he checked in, he again thought of Dan Killian's parting words, "Stay close to your own people." After leaving the taxi, he had walked to Times Square, not wanting to check into any hotel during the small morning hours. He spent the 5.5 hours from 3:30 to 9 in an all-night perverto show. He had wanted desperately to sleep, but both times he had dozed off, he had been snapped awake by the feel of light fingers crawling up his inner thigh.
"How long will you be staying, sir?"
the desk clerk asked, glancing at Richard's registration as John G. Springer.
"Don't know,"
Richard said, trying for meek affability. "All depends on the clients, you understand?" He paid $60, holding the room for 2 days, and took the elevator up to the 23rd floor. The room offered a somber view of the squalid East River. It was raining in New York, too. The room was clean, but sterile. There was a connecting bathroom, and the toilet made constant, ominous noises that Richards could not rectify, even by wiggling the ball in the tank. He had breakfast sent up. A poached egg on toast, orange drink, coffee. When the boy appeared with the tray, he tipped lightly and forgettably. With breakfast out of the way, he took out the video camera and looked at it. A small metal plate labeled instructions was set just below the viewfinder. Richards read, "Number 1, push tape cartridge into slot marked A until it clicks home. Number 2, set viewfinder by means of crosshairs within the sight. Number 3, push button marked B to record sound with video. Number 4, when the bell sounds, tape cartridge will pop out automatically. Recording time, 10 minutes.
Good, Richards thought. They can watch me sleep.
He set the camera on the bureau next to the Gideon Bible and sighted the crosshairs on the bed. The wall behind was blank and nondescript. He didn't see how anyone could pinpoint his location from either the bed or the background. Street noise from this height was negligible, but he would leave the shower running just in case. Even with forethought, he nearly pressed the button and stepped into the camera's field of vision with his naked disguise hanging out.
Some of it could have been removed, but the gray hair had to stay. He put the pillow slip over his head. Then he pressed the button, walked over to the bed, and sat down facing the lens. "Peekaboo," Ben Richards said hollowly to his immense listening and viewing audience that would watch this tape later tonight with horrified interest.
"You can't see it, but I'm laughing at you shit-eaters."
He lay back, closed his eyes, and tried to think of nothing at all. When the tape clip popped open 10 minutes later, he was fast asleep. -75, and counting. When he woke up, it was just after 4 p.m. The hunt was on then. Had been for 3 hours, figuring for the time difference. The thought sent a chill through his middle. He put a new tape in the camera, took down the Gideon Bible and read the Ten Commandments over and over for 10 minutes with the pillow slip on his head. There were envelopes in the desk drawer, but the name and address of the hotel was on them. He hesitated and knew it made no difference. He would have to take Killian's word that his location, as revealed by postmarks or return addresses, would not be revealed to McCone and his bird dogs by the games authority. He had to use the postal service. They had supplied it with no carrier pigeons. There was a mail drop by the elevators, and Richards dropped the clips into the out-of-town slot with huge misgivings. Although postal authorities were not eligible for any games money for reporting the whereabouts of contestants, it still seemed like a horribly risky thing to do. But the only other thing was default, and he couldn't do that either. He went back to his room, shut off the shower, the bathroom was as steamy as a tropical jungle, and lay down on the bed to think. How to run? What was the best thing to do? He tried to put himself in the place of an average contestant. The first impulse, of course, was pure animal instinct. Go to Earth. Make a den and cower in there. And so he had done. The Brandt Hotel. Would the hunters expect that? Yes. They would not be looking for a running man at all. They would be looking for a hiding man. Could they find him in his den? He wanted very badly to answer no, but he could not. His disguise was good, but hastily put together. Not many people are observant, but there are always some. Perhaps he'd been tabbed already. The desk clerk, the bellboy who had brought his breakfast, perhaps even by one of the faceless men in the Perferto show on 42nd Street. Not likely, but possible. And what about his real protection, the false ID Molly had provided? Good for how long? Well, the taxi driver, who had taken him from the games building, could put him in South City, and the hunters were fearfully, dreadfully good. They would be leaning hard on everyone he knew, from Jack Crager to that bitch Eileen Jenner down the hall. Heavy heat. How long until somebody, maybe a head softy like Flapper Donegan, let it slip that he had forged papers on occasion? And if they found Molly, he was blown. The pawnbroker would hold out long enough to take a belting around. He was canny enough to want a few visible battle scars to sport around the neighborhood, just so his place didn't have a bad case of spontaneous combustion some night. Then, a simple check of Harding's 3 jet ports would uncover John G. Springer's midnight jaunt to Freak City. If they found Molly. You assume they will. You have to assume they will. Then run. Where? He didn't know. He had spent his entire life in Harding, in the Midwest. He didn't know the East Coast. There was no place here he could run to and feel that he was on familiar turf. So where? Where? His teased and unhappy mind drifted into a morbid daydream. They had found Molly with no trouble at all, pried the Springer name out of him in an easy 5 minutes after pulling 2 fingernails, filling his navel with lighter fluid and threatening to strike a match. They had gotten Richard's flight number with 1 quick call. Handsome, nondescript man in gabardine coats of identical cut and make, and had arrived in New York by 2:30 Eastern Standard Time. Advance men had already gotten the address of the Brandt by a telex canvas of the New York City hotel listings, which were computer-tabulated day by day.
They were outside now, surrounding the place. Busboys and bellboys and clerks and bartenders had been replaced by hunters. Half a dozen coming up the fire escape. Another 50 packing all three elevators. More and more pulling up in air cars all around the building. Now they were in the hall, and in a moment, the door would crash open and they would lunge in, a tape machine grinding enthusiastically away on a rolling tripod above their muscular shoulders, getting it all down for posterity as they turned him into hamburger. Richard sat up, sweating. Didn't even have a gun. Not yet. Run. Fast. Boston would do, to start. -74, and counting. He left his room at 5 p.m. and went down to the lobby. The desk clerk smiled brightly, probably looking forward to his evening relief.
Afternoon, Mr. Springer.
Richard smiled back.
I seem to have struck oil, my man. Three clients who seem receptive. I'll be occupying your excellent facility for an additional 2 days. May I pay in advance? Certainly, sir.
Dollars changed hands. Still beaming, Richards went back up to his room. The hall was empty. Richards hung the Do Not Disturb sign on the doorknob and went quickly to the fire stairs. Luck was with him, and he met no one. He went all the way to the ground floor and slipped out the side entrance, unobserved. The rain had stopped, but the clouds still hung and lowered over Manhattan. The air smelled like a rancid battery. Richards walked briskly, discarding the limp, to the Port Authority electric bus terminal. A man could still buy a ticket on a Greyhound without signing his name. Boston, he said to the bearded ticket vendor.
$23, pal. Bus pulls out at 6:15 sharp.
He passed over the money. It left him with something less than 3,000 new dollars. He had an hour to kill, and the terminal was chock full of people. Many of them, Vol Army, with their blue berets and blank, boyish, brutal faces. He bought a pervert mag, sat down, and propped it in front of his face. For the next hour, he stared at it, turning a page occasionally to try and avoid looking like a statue. When the bus rolled up to the pier, he shuffled toward the open doors with the rest of the nondescript assortment.
Hey! Hey, you!
Richard stared around. A security cop was approaching on the run. He froze, unable to take flight. A distant part of his brain was screaming that he was about to be cut down right here in this shitty bus terminal with wads of gum on the floor and casual obscenities scrawled on the dirt-caked walls. He was going to be some dumb flatfoot's fluke trophy.
Stop him! Stop that guy!
The cop was veering. It wasn't him at all. Richard saw. It was a scruffy-looking kid who was running for the stairs, swinging a lady's purse in one hand and bowling bystanders this way and that like tenpins. He and his pursuer disappeared from sight, taking the stairs three by three in huge leaps. The knot of embarkers, debarkers, and greeters watched them with vague interest for a moment and then picked up the threads of what they'd been doing, as if nothing had happened. Richards stood in line, trembling and cold. He collapsed into a seat near the back of the coach, and a few minutes later, the bus hummed smoothly up the ramp, paused, and joined the flow of traffic. The cop and his quarry had disappeared into the general mob of humanity. If I'd had a gun, I would have burned him where he stood, Richards thought. Christ. Oh, Christ. And on the heels of that, next time it won't be a purse snatcher. It'll be you. He would get a gun in Boston anyway. Somehow. He remembered Laughlin saying that he would push a few of them out a high window before they took him. The bus rolled north in the gathering darkness. -73 and counting. The Boston YMCA stood on Upper Huntington Avenue. It was huge, black with years, old-fashioned and boxy. It stood in what used to be one of Boston's better areas in the middle of the last century. It stood there like a guilty reminder of another time, another day, its old-fashioned neon still winking its letters toward the Senfu Theater District. It looked like the skeleton of a murdered idea. When Richards walked into the lobby, the desk clerk was arguing with a tiny, scruffy black boy in a killball jersey so big that it reached down over his blue jeans to mid-shin. The disputed territory seemed to be a gum machine that stood inside the lobby door.
I lost my nickel, hunk. I lost my motherfucking nickel.
If you don't get out of here, I'll call a house detective, kid. That's all. I'm done talking to you.
But that goddamn machine took my nickel.
You stop swearing, you little scumbag.
The clerk, who looked an old, cold 30, reached down and shook the jersey. It was too huge for him to be able to shake the boy inside, too.
Now get out of here. I'm through talking.
Seeing he meant it, the almost comic mask of hate and defiance below the dark sunburst of the kid's afro broke into a hurt, agonized grimace of disbelief.
Listen, that's the only motherfucking nigga I got. That gumball machine ain't my nigga. That
I'm calling a house dick right now.
The clerk turned toward the switchboard. His jacket, a refugee from some bargain counter, flapped tiredly around his thin butt. The boy kicked the black steel post of the gum machine, then ran.
Motherfucking white honky some bitch!
The clerk looked at him, the security button, real or mythical, unpressed. He smiled at Richards, showing an old keyboard with a few missing keys.
You can't talk to niggas anymore. I keep them in cages if I run a network.
He really lose a nickel? Richards asked, signing the register as John Deegan from Michigan.
If he did, he stole it,
the clerk said.
Oh, I suppose he did, but if I gave him a nickel, I'd have the 200 pickaninnies in here by nightfall claiming the same thing. Where did they learn that language? That's what I want to know. Don't their folks care what they do?
How long will you be staying, Mr. Deegan?
I don't know. I'm in town on business.
He tried on a greasy smile, and when it felt right, he widened it. The desk clerk recognized it instantly, perhaps from his own reflection, looking up at him from the depths of the fake marble counter, which had been polished by a million elbows, and gave it back to him.
That's $15.50, Mr. Deegan.
He pushed a key attached to a worn wooden tongue across the counter to Richards.
Room 512. Thank you.
Richards paid cash. Again, no ID. Thank God for the YMCA. He crossed to the elevators and looked down the corridor to the Christian Lending Library on the left. It was dimly lit with fly-specked yellow globes, and an old man wearing an overcoat and galoshes was perusing a tract, turning the pages slowly and methodically with a trembling, wetted finger. Richards could hear the clogged whistle of his breathing from where he was by the elevators, and felt a mixture of sorrow and horror. The elevator clunked to a stop, and the doors opened with wheezy reluctance. As he stepped in, the clerk said loudly,
"It's a sin and a shame. I put them all in cages."
Richards glanced up, thinking the clerk was speaking to him, but the clerk was not looking at anything. The lobby was very empty and very silent. -72 and counting. The fifth-floor hall stank of pee. The corridor was narrow enough to make Richards feel claustrophobic, and the carpet, which might have been red, had worn away in the middle to random strings. The doors were industrial gray, and several of them showed the marks of fresh kicks, smashes, or attempts to jimmy. Signs at every 20 paces advised that there would be no smoking in this hall by order of fire marshal. There was a communal bathroom in the center, and the urine stench became suddenly sharp. It was a smell Richards associated automatically with despair. People moved restlessly behind the gray doors like animals in cages, animals too awful, too frightening to be seen. Someone was chanting what might have been the Hail Mary over and over in a drunken voice. Strange gobbling noises came from behind another door. A country western tune from behind another.
I ain't got a buck for the phone, and I'm so alone.
Shuffling noises. The solitary squeak of bed springs that might mean a man in his own hand. Sobbing. Laughter. The hysterical grunts of a drunken argument. And from behind these, silence. and silence. A man with a hideously sunken chest walked past Richards without looking at him, carrying a bar of soap and a towel in one hand, wearing gray pajama bottoms tied with string. He wore paper slippers on his feet. Richards unlocked his room and stepped in. There was a police bar on the inside, and he used it. There was a bed with almost white sheets and an army surplus blanket. There was a bureau, from which the second drawer was missing. There was a picture of Jesus on one wall. There was a steel rod with two coat hangers, kitty-cornered in the right angle of two walls. There was nothing else but the window, which looked out on blackness. It was 10:15. Richards hung up his jacket, slipped off his shoes, and lay down on the bed. He realized how miserable and unknown and vulnerable he was in the world. The universe seemed to shriek and clatter and roar around him like a huge, indifferent jalopy rushing down a hill and toward the lip of a bottomless chasm. His lips began to tremble, and then he cried a little. He didn't put it on tape. He lay looking at the ceiling, which was cracked into a million crazy scrawls like a bad potter's glaze. They'd been after him for over 8 hours now. He had earned $800 of his stake money. Christ, not even out of the hole yet. And he'd missed himself on Freebie. Christ, yes. The bag over the head, spectacular. Where were they? Still in Harding? New York? Or on their way to Boston? No, they couldn't be on their way here, could they? The bus had not passed through any roadblocks. He'd left the biggest city in the world anonymously, and he was here under an assumed name. They couldn't be on to him. No way. The Boston Y might be safe for as long as 2 days. After that, he could move north toward New Hampshire and Vermont, or south toward Hartford or Philadelphia, or even Atlanta. Further east was the ocean, and beyond it was Britain and Europe. It was an intriguing idea, but probably out of reach. Passage by plane required ID. What with France under martial law, and while stowing away might be possible, discovery would mean a quick and final end to the whole thing. And West was out. West was where the heat was the hottest. If you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Who has said that? Molly would know. He snickered a little and felt better. The disembodied sound of a radio came to his ears. It would be good to get the gun now, tonight, but he was too tired. The ride had tired him. Being a fugitive tired him. And he knew, in an animal way that went deeper than the rational, that very soon he might be sleeping in an October cold culvert or in a weed and cinder-choked gully. The gun tomorrow night. He turned off the light and went to bed. -71 and counting. It was showtime again. Richard stood with his buttocks toward the video recorder, humming the theme music to The Running Man. A YMCA pillow slip was over his head, turned inside out so the name stamped on its hem wouldn't show. The camera had inspired Richards to a kind of creative humor that he never would have believed he possessed. The self-image he'd always held was that of a rather dour man, with little or no humor in his outlook. The prospect of his approaching death had uncovered a solitary comedian hiding inside. When the clip popped out, he decided to save the second for afternoon. The solitary room was boring, and perhaps something else would occur to him. He dressed slowly and then went to the window and looked out. Thursday morning traffic hustled busily up and down Huntington Avenue. Both sidewalks were crowded with slowly moving pedestrians. Some of them were scanning bright yellow help wanted facts. Most of them just walked. There was a cop, it seemed, on every corner. Richards could hear them in his mind. Move along. Ain't you got someplace to go?
Pick it up, maggot.
So you moved on to the next corner, which was just like the last corner, and were moved along again. You could try to get mad about it, but mostly your feet hurt too much. Richards debated the risk of going down the hall and showering. He finally decided it would be okay. He went down with a towel over his shoulder, met no one, and walked into the bathroom.
essence of urine, shit, puke, and disinfectant mingled. All the crapper doors had been yanked off, of course. Someone had scrawled "Fuck the Network" in foot-high letters above the urinal. It looked as though he might have been angry when he did it. There was a pile of feces in one of the urinals. Someone must have been really drunk, Richards thought. A few sluggish autumn flies were crawling over it. He was not disgusted. The sight was too common. But he was matter-of-factly glad he'd worn his shoes. He also had the shower room to himself. The floor was cracked porcelain, the walls gouged tile, with thick runnels of decay near the bottoms. He turned on a rust-clogged showerhead, full hot, and waited patiently for 5 minutes until the water ran tepid, and then showered quickly. He used a scrap of soap he found on the floor. The Y had either neglected to supply it, or the chambermaid had walked off with his. On his way back to his room, a man with a hair lip gave him a tract. Richards tucked his shirt in, sat on his bed, and lit a cigarette. He was hungry, but would wait until dusk to go out and eat. Boredom drove him to the window again. He counted different makes of cars: Fords, Chevys, Wents, VWs, Plymouths, Studebakers, Rambler Supremes. First one to 100 wins. A dull game, but better than no game. Further up Huntington Avenue was Northeastern University, and directly across the street from the Y was a large automated bookshop. While he counted cars, Richards watched the students come and go. They were in sharp contrast to the wanted fax idlers. Their hair was shorter, and they all seemed to be wearing tartan jumpers, which were this year's campus craze. They walked through the milling ruck and inside to make their purchases with an air of uncomfortable patronization and hail fellow that left a curdled amusement in Richard's mouth. The 5 minute spaces in front of the store filled and emptied with sporty, flashy cars, often of exotic make. Most of them had college decals in the back windows: Northeastern, MIT, Boston College, Harvard. Most of the news fax bums treated the sporty cars as part of the scenery, but a few looked at them with dumb and wretched longing. A Went pulled out of the space directly in front of the store, and a Ford pulled in, settling to an inch above the pavement as the driver, a crew-cut fellow smoking a foot-long cigar, put it in idle. The car dipped slightly as his passenger, a dude in a brown and white hunting jacket, got out and zipped inside. Richards sighed. Counting cars was a very poor game. Fords were ahead of their nearest contender by a score of 78-40, the outcome going to be predictable as the next election. Someone pounded on the door and Richard stiffened like a bolt. "Frankie! You in there? Frankie!" Richard said nothing. Frozen with fear, he played a statue. "You eat shit, Frankie baby!" There was a chortle of drunken laughter, and the footsteps moved on, pounding on the next door up. "You in there, Frankie?" Richard's heart slipped slowly down from his throat. The Ford was pulling out, and another Ford took its place. Number 79. Shit. The day slipped into afternoon, and then it was 1 o'clock. Richards knew this by the ringing of various chimes in churches far away. Ironically, the man living by the clock had no watch. He was playing a variation of the car game now. Fords, worth 2 points. Studebakers, 3. Wentz, 4. First one to 500 wins. It was perhaps 15 minutes later that he noticed the young man in the brown and white hunting jacket leaning against a lamppost beyond the bookstore and reading a concert poster. He was not being moved along. In fact, the police seemed to be ignoring him. "You're jumping at shadows, maggot. Next you'll see them in the corners." He counted a Went with a dented fender, a yellow Ford, an old Studebaker with a wheezing air cylinder dipping in slight cycles, a VW, and no good, they're out of the running, another Went, a Studebaker. A man smoking a foot-long cigar was standing nonchalantly at the bus stop on the corner. He was the only person there, with good reason. Richards had seen the buses come and go,
and knew there wouldn't be another one along for 45 minutes. Richards felt a coolness creep into his testicles. An old man in a threadbare black overcoat sauntered down the side of the street and leaned casually against the building. Two fellows in tartan jumpers got out of a taxi, talking animatedly, and began to study the menu in the window of the Stockholm restaurant. A cop walked over and conversed with the man at the bus stop. Then the cop walked away again. Richards noted, with a numb, distant terror, that a good many of the newspaper bums were idling along much more slowly. Their clothes and styles of walking seemed oddly familiar, as if they had been around a great many times before, and Richards was just becoming aware of it. In the tentative, uneasy way you recognize the voices of the dead in dreams. There were more cops, too. I'm being bracketed, he thought. The idea brought a helpless, rabid terror. No, his mind corrected. You've already been bracketed.